Okay, so we're now live, and as I mentioned when the recording was off, I'm going to start by reading a short statement, then I'm going to ask some permission from you, and then we're going to go ahead with the interview. So today is May 6, 2016. My name is Philip Scarpino, professor of history and director of public history at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and I have the pleasure to be interviewing Mr. Joseph Bumbleberg in the offices of the law firm of Ball Eggleston, located in Lafayette, Indiana. Mr. Bumbleberg is senior member and president of the Ball Eggleston firm. Also in the room are Abigail Delf and Jacqueline Hauser, student service learning assistants funded by the Office of Service and Learning at IUPUI, and both will be participating in this interview. Today's interview with Mr. Bumbleberg is part of a larger oral history project that focuses on the American Red Cross of Indiana that will interview individuals who volunteered for the Red Cross, worked for the Red Cross, donated to the Red Cross, and who were served by the Red Cross. This project coincides with the 100th anniversary of the American Red Cross of Indiana. We're interviewing Mr. Bumbleberg because of a lifetime of volunteer service to the Red Cross. We'll include a full list of his Red Cross service with the interview, but for current purposes, he was president of the Tippecanoe County Junior Red Cross in 1958, member of the board of directors of the Tippecanoe chapter from 1966 to the present, which included four terms as chapter chairman. He was a member of the board of governors, American National Red Cross from 1975 to 81, and a member of the Council of Former Red Cross Governors from 1981 to the present. So I'd like to ask your permission to do the following: to record this interview, to deposit this interview in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives and with the American Red Cross of Indiana, and to allow the directors of those two organizations or their representatives to make the interviews available to patrons, including potential posting of all or part of this recording to their internet sites.
You have my permission.
All right, thank you very much. So, we'll get started, and as I mentioned again when the recorder was off, we're going to ask you some basic softball demographic questions and begin with when and where you were born.
I was born in Lafayette, Indiana.
Okay, and when were you born?
1937, January 5th.
Okay, who were your parents?
My dad was Theodore Bumbleberg, and my mother was Elizabeth.
And what did your dad do for a living?
My father was a printing salesman for various companies. He specialized in selling to governmental organizations the peculiar paper that courts and clerks and government agencies use. Things like warrants and subpoenas and all that crazy paperwork that courts and public offices use.
Huh. And your mom?
My mother started as a proofreader because of being with Dad in the printing business, and she ended up being an employee of the Lafayette Journal and Courier, and for some time she was a proofreader. Her and three or four other ladies proofread everything that went into the paper, and then ultimately technology changed and proofreaders became passe, and she became then the operator of what they called their job shop, which was an internal printing operation that printed their stationery and the cards that go into their machines and all of that internal kind of printing. She did all that, everything from setting the type to buying the ink. And when she got all that done, she finally retired and lasted about 30 days in retirement. And then they called her back and asked her if she would come back and work part-time as the telephone operator and receptionist for the paper. And become, in effect, the front face to anybody who walked in off the street, which she did. She worked for the newspaper for 46 years. She died an unhappy woman because she fell going to work and broke her hip.
Oh, no.
And when that happened, it unraveled everything, and so she was never able to go back. She had a goal in her mind of wanting to work 50 years, and she didn't make it. And that's why she died unhappy, because she didn't make that goal. She was a goal-oriented lady.
So did you learn about how to manage retirement from your mother?
No, not at all.
I mean, you're semi-retired, right?
Well,
but a busy man.
I'm busy, and I don't know whether it's semi-retired or what it is. I work when I find things that I like to do.
Are you goal-oriented?
Pardon?
Are you goal-oriented?
Oh, probably so.
Yeah.
Probably so.
Did you have any brothers and sisters?
I have a sister. She's about 6 years younger than I am. She lives in Brownsburg. With her husband.
So you grew up here in Lafayette?
Grew up here in Lafayette. Went to school here.
Where'd you go to high school?
Went to Jefferson High School.
And that's a public school?
That's a public school, yes.
So what were you like in high school?
Well, I wasn't big enough to make most of the athletic teams, but I did the usual kinds of stuff. I made my grades, and you know, and I'm not sure I was an extraordinary student, but I made them. And to find other things, I belonged to a couple of the organizations. But mostly what I did was, since I wasn't big enough to make the lowest weight on the wrestling team, the coach, an old gentleman by the name of Norm Willie, said to me, "I think I can use you." And he made me the student manager of the wrestling team.
Uh-huh.
And in that job, I helped him schedule the practices, get the equipment ready, do all that stuff that needed to be done. And indeed, I would even at times call practices. And when I knew he wanted one and hadn't got the notice up, I'd put it up. Little things like that. When we ran tournaments, I recruited his timekeepers and all that kind of stuff. Everything necessary to be a kind of an administrator. I also did that for the track team, who, interestingly enough, the track coach was Mr. Martin, the wife, or the husband of the woman who got me involved in the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did pretty much the same thing. So these two only really great men and coaches kind of taught me the art of athletic administration.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a lot of that. And when you're involved in that, you travel a fair amount. There might be a couple of nights a week you'd be on the road.
With the teams?
With the team, yeah. Sure. Might drive to Bloomington for a wrestling match. Or mostly the track meets were on Saturdays because they were multiple meets, relays. Mm-hmm. So it might be in South Bend or wherever the meets were. And we all generally traveled by car, sometimes by bus.
So you got to go all over the state?
Went all over the state, got to know all kinds of interesting people. And it was just a fun educational experience.
And they trusted you?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So when you were in high school, do you think that you stood out as an organizer and a...
Well, probably. And the other thing I did...
Leaders?
The other thing I did when I was in high school is I was on the yearbook staff.
Mm-hmm.
And I ultimately became the editor my senior year of the Jefferson High School yearbook. I just kept busy.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you must have gotten good grades because you made it into Notre Dame.
Well, that is a story on that, too. When I got to Notre Dame, the guy at the admissions we were planning my freshman schedule of classes. And he looked at my transcript, and then he said to me, "You know, how in the name of heavens did you ever get in here?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "You don't have a foreign language." And Notre Dame had some kind of foreign language requirement, and I had none, zero. So someplace I escaped through the system in high school of never taking a foreign language. Well, let me tell you, they caught up with me at South Bend, and I took 16 hours of college Spanish to catch up on that requirement that I didn't have.
So, just in the interest of full disclosure for anybody who listens to this recording in the future, we met with you on April 22nd and got to know each other and chatted. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, you mentioned that you were with the track team in high school and that you had a chance, along with other members of the track team, to get out of study hall and help the Red Cross with the Bloodmobile.
That's true.
So was that the first time that you
volunteered
for the Red Cross?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And, of course, as I told you, the track coach's wife was the executive director of the Tippecanoe County chapter of the Red Cross. And so she used her connection with her husband to get strong backs to lift all that stuff out of the back end of the trucks for the Bloodmobile.
Mm-hmm. So the track coach's wife's name was what?
Her name was Emily Martin.
And she was a long time...
Oh, forever. Actually, and everybody called her Mickey. I never did understand where that came from, but that Mickey Martin was the executive director. She was the director in the 1950s when I was in high school, and she was still here when I got out of the Army in 1960s.
What do you remember about her?
I remember that she was a very gracious lady. She was a worker. She was a good recruiter. She was a lovely host when you were in her home, and that she was a believer in the Red Cross. Back in those days, we did everything that Red Cross chapters back in those days did.
She was a volunteer?
No, she was a paid staff person.
Yeah.
And I'm sure if we went back and looked at the salary, she never got paid what she was worth. But she was a dandy lady, and she was a good organizer. And she had the ability to accumulate people to be around her, to do things. So she accumulated people to be the chairman of volunteers, and she accumulated people to be the youth leaders and all that kind of stuff. So she was a good recruiter. She was just a good person.
She accumulated you eventually.
Well, she did. That's right. She sure did.
So, again, when we talked on April 22nd, you said that when you were growing up, that your mother said to you on more than one occasion, you got to put back.
Right? That's right. That was her theory. And you know, and a little bit of that is when I was in school and there were things to be done at school, my mother and dad participated in doing them. You know, if she was, if it needed to be a cookies for something at church, she did. Mm-hmm. If the Father's Club needed to do something to repair in the school, dad did. And, you know, so I had that example of them participating and doing the things that needed to be done.
So as you moved on with your life and with your career, how did your mother's advice shape your own career?
Well, I always had to think in terms of when somebody came and asked me to do something, did I have time and was it something that I would like to do, and did it have value for the community? And I kind of made those kinds of judgments. And as a result, this is a great town. If you study Lafayette, it's a fascinating place.
What makes it a great town?
Well, good people, good educational system, a Big Ten school, and a history of community efforts. I went to a town in Indiana one year when I was chairman of the Red Cross. And they were having a terrible time with their fundraising and everything. And I had the division chairman out of Indianapolis. His picture may be on the wall down there, John Russell. Mm-hmm. And he was an interesting character. And we went to Terre Haute to see what was wrong. And we met with the Terre Haute United Way. And they were about 8 weeks or 10 weeks or something into their campaign and only did about 10% of their calls. Well, that's a recipe for disaster. And I remember Mr. Russell said to him, you people are just not getting the job done, which I thought was not as politic as he might have been, but that was the way it was. And finally, as he and I warmed up to pushing these people to get things done, the president of the thing down there turned on me, and he said to me, hey, boy, where are you from? And I said, I'm from Lafayette. And he said, oh, he said, I know about you people in Lafayette. That's a town where wherever you see something that needs to be done, y'all get together and do it. Took me about halfway back till it dawned on me that that guy had given Lafayette the best compliment that he could put together, an accurate appraisal of this town. Mm-hmm. And that's where we are still today.
Is that why you stayed here all these years?
Yeah, but I know all kinds of people here. I was born here. The thought of going someplace else and acquiring all that, you know, and my mother was here and she worked here and everybody knew her. Dad was here. And all of Dad's family was here. My mother's family was here. You know, we had roots in the community, and I never was one to think that that made any sense to go someplace where I didn't know anybody.
Is your wife local?
Well, kind of. She's from a... She's from a farm community in Fountain County, mm-hmm. which is a county immediately south and west of us here that abuts Tippecanoe County. Mm-hmm. She has a family farm that is just west of a Tippecanoe County town called Odell. Mm-hmm. You're all smiling like you know where Odell is. But Odell is a wide spot in the road, I'll tell you. But she was from there. She went to Attica High School. Mm-hmm. And I met her because she came to Lafayette after she graduated to get a job. Mm-hmm. And she got a job at what was then Purdue National Bank. And at Purdue National Bank, she got a job as a clerk in the installment loan division of the bank. And that was the department that took care of all of the car loans, all of that busy work. And the youngest lawyer in the office, and I became that at some point, got the job of taking care of that department, you know. And so I was there, and then I met her because she had gravitated to become the chief clerk in that department. And when I got out of the Army, there she was. And so it started right then.
Is the farm still in her family?
Yes. She and her sister-in-law own the farm yet.
So we talked about the fact that your mom told you that you got to put back. What else did you learn from your mother that influenced the adult you became?
Well, I watched my mother and my dad both work hard. You know, both of them had a job. Both of them did a very, very well capable system of taking care of my sister and I. But they supported what we did. And, you know, I had an edge when I take a paper and write it for school. And then I take it home to my mother and say, read this.
I was going to ask you if your mother read your papers, but it seems...
Heaven's yes, if you've got a professional proofreader there, why not? Use every edge you can get. And so she would punctuate and correct my spelling and that sort of stuff.
Did you learn to write from your mother?
No, I learned my composition and stuff from a high school teacher. Mm-hmm. We had a gentleman that taught at the high school by the name of Jack Hopkins. And he was a character by all means, but he taught composition. And he taught it very well. And the standard story was that if you passed Mr. Hopkins' composition class in your senior year, you would probably be able to test out of English in your freshman year in college.
Did it work for you?
Yes. Yeah, he was very good about it. He was, like I said, but he was a character, and he was the tennis coach, too. And a flaming Democrat. Unbelievable.
Were they rare in Lafayette in those days?
No. Democrats were pretty accustomed to this community. He was married to a flaming Republican, and the great stories about the two of them would get into discussions. They were beautiful, but they were two wonderful people. But he was a great teacher, and even to this day, people in my class, of which there are still a fair amount of us around, would tell you that that one of the best teachers they ever had was Mr. Hopkins.
What do you think makes a great teacher?
Well, first of all, he cared about students. Secondly, he demanded that you do the work. Mm-hmm. And then he corrected it and he taught. But if you were having trouble in his class, he would spend whatever time it took, mostly at 6:30 or 7 o'clock in the morning, to tutor you. He had this. I think he really did. He liked the kids, loved the students, and he was good at his business. He knew punctuation, did spelling. I'll tell you.
Do you think of yourself as a teacher?
Not really. Although I've done that. You know, I spent 3 years on active duty in the military, a lot of which was as an instructor at a military, U.S. Army school. And even to this day, when I get a chance, I go over to Purdue and guest lecture in the civil engineering school or in the ag school in the agronomy department for two friends of mine that have classes over there. And so I go over and do their classes.
So we talked about your mother and father. Were there any other adults that you encountered while you were growing up here in Lafayette that really had an impact on the man you became?
Well, as long as I grew up, my grandmother and grandfather lived right next door. Mm-hmm. And so I was always with my granddad. You know, I was grandpa's boy. Mm-hmm. And I hear people talk about that who really don't understand what that means. But wherever grandpa went when I was a little guy, I went with him. Mm-hmm. If he was going up the street to play cards at the used car lot, I was with him. If he was going to go with his friend Tommy to bring back a wrecked car from the wrecker service that Tommy had, I rode in the front seat. There I was. And so I was with Grandpa all the time. And he was a journeyman plumber. He was a troubleshooter for the Indiana Gas Company. And he was a red-headed Irishman who had a great sense of humor. And his skill at being a plumber was very good. But being around him, I just learned things like, well, my mother always said it was bad because I picked up some bad language, him and the guys at the car lot. But you get over that. But Grandpa was a strong personality, and you just adopted that feeling when you were with him. My grandmother was a strong woman, too, so she was next door, too. And she came out of that generation where when her two bachelor brothers got sick at the end of their life, guess who took care of them?
She did.
She did. She did. So I saw Uncle John die in that house and Uncle George die in that house because Grandma was thought it was her duty.
So your grandparents lived right next to your parents?
Double house.
Yeah.
You know, the old houses where you one door and an entry hall and then that way. Yeah.
So family was important.
Family was very important. Family was very important.
While you were growing up in Lafayette in the 50s, were there any events that took place that had an impact on the adult that you became later on?
Gee, I don't know. That was the time of the, you know, before the 50s, right there at the end, we were winding down World War II, and my uncles who had been military had all started to come home and get established. And then in the 50s, we had the Korean War again, and I was a little remote from that because I was in high school and probably didn't understand completely what I was reading and knew about it. But beyond that, I have no recollection of anything really greatly significant that molded me at all.
So what year did you graduate from high school?
1954.
Okay, when you graduated in 1954, what did you imagine the future would hold for Joe Bumbleberg?
I didn't have any idea. I knew I was supposed to go to college because in that era, everybody was supposed to go to college, and so I did. But beyond that, getting through college was it. Maybe I was a little warped. I had an uncle who was a lawyer, and he was a graduate of Notre Dame, too. And he, all through growing up, Uncle Francis would talk to me about going to law school and going to Notre Dame, and Murph was that way, and maybe he molded me more than I really know, because when I got out of high school, I applied only to one college. I don't know what that happened. If I hadn't gotten in, I'd had to start over or something. I got to one college, and I was always thought that being a lawyer is what Murph wanted, so that sounded like a pretty good idea, and I know watched. He had a good practice and a good living out of it, so why not? So I did.
So your family is of Irish extraction?
Well, mother's family was of Irish extraction, and dad's was German.
Catholic?
Yes.
What impact did growing up Catholic have on you?
Well, you know, in Lafayette's a town that is a lot Catholic. And it had a lot because I went to St. Mary's Grade School, which, by the way, was the same school that my mother went to. And Dad went to St. Lawrence. And back in those days, you know, the old tradition of a married couple and what church did they go to and all those things prevailed. So they were married in Mother's Church, and so that's where we went. And then I went and had a good grade school. And back in those days, we had the nuns, and they were great teachers. And so I think that they... What I got out of Catholic education was, first of all, faith, and secondly, they taught the classes well. I could read and write and do numbers and do all those kinds of things that you're supposed to get out of grade school. So when I went to the high school, I was reasonably well prepared. And at that time, there was no Catholic high school here in town, so everybody went to Jeff.
So I noticed from reading your resume that you've maintain an affiliation with the Knights of Columbus for almost your entire life, right? So,
because of my father.
What role did faith play in the man that you became, particularly when it relates to being a volunteer?
Well, you know, I watch the Knights of Columbus, and they are a volunteer organization, and they do all kinds of things, and they support to the degree that they can the Catholic high school here in town. They support the boys' home at Gibault at Terre Haute. They do that. They do charity work of all kinds. The fourth degree is those are the ones with the fancy hat and the swords, and they do things that support the church. And up at my parish right now, every month they have a pancake breakfast, and the money that they get for that goes to reduce the price of our renovation. And they're going to have a car show here, I see, coming up shortly, and I don't know what they're going to do with that money, but I'm sure there's a place to put it. And I got tangled up in it because my dad was a member of the Knights of Columbus. When I came home from the Army, I hadn't been home 30 seconds until he said, get your checkbook out and write a check to the Knights of Columbus. Here's the number, put it in there. I said, what am I doing? And he said, you're joining. No young Catholic lawyer in Lafayette worth his salt doesn't belong to the Knights of Columbus. So I joined.
But you stuck with it, too.
But I stuck with it. Well, there's a lot of interesting guys, and it's an occasional place to go by and drink a beer with the fellas, and I know a lot of those guys down there.
And there's those pancakes.
Well, and I don't eat the pancakes.
Whenever I think about the Knights of Columbus, I think about pancakes.
Well, but you got to think of fish fries, too. Every Friday night, they have a fish fry down here. And then, it was a question of doing the things. Dad became Grand Knight of the Council here, and then he became the District Deputy Grand Knight. And I discovered the other night that one of my closest friends said to me, by the way, did you know that when I was Grand Knight, my friend saying that your dad was the district deputy? I said, no, I didn't know that at all. And so there is this funny kind of relationship. That's the other thing about Lafayette that makes it strong. This friend of mine that I was talking to the other night down there, I go to church with Joey all the time. His dad and my dad went to grade school together. So there's a lot of that tie in the town here.
A network with deep
it's
family
groups. It's a
funny
kind of family groups and networks, and they're raised around schools and churches and that sort of stuff. The joke in Lafayette is that before you criticize somebody, you better figure out who he's related to, because you may be offending somebody's aunt or cousin. But there is a lot of that, and that Lafayette is Catholic enough that we have a Catholic mayor. And his predecessor was a Catholic, and his predecessor for 24 years was a Catholic mayor. So we have that in Lafayette. It's an interesting kind of, like I say, it's a really fascinating community from those kinds of things. And of course, it helps around here that it is the seat of the Roman Catholic Diocese of India, Lafayette, Indiana. Mm-hmm. And having the chancery here with the bishop and all that kind of stuff does add some extra weight, if you will, to the church's presence in the community.
So in just a second, I'm going to hand off to my colleagues here and see if they have any follow-up questions. But did you in part go to Notre Dame because you're Catholic?
No, not really. I went because I think my Uncle Francis wanted me to go there. And I knew that it had a good law school.
Yeah.
And it certainly didn't hurt that.
No, Notre Dame has a law school.
Yeah, they have a good law school. And so, although I didn't go there, that yet another part of life. But I went there. I knew it was Catholic. But that wasn't a compelling part of the decision. It was I knew it was a good school. And of course, I had been, as a little kid, a fan of Notre Dame. Now, one of the interesting things that happens in this town, or did, was when Notre Dame came here to play football. Now, they messed up the schedule, and I don't think they're going to play this year with Purdue, but when they came to town, the Notre Dame football team would stay at a motel out on the edge of town. Mm-hmm. They'd come down on Friday. On their way to Ross-Ade Stadium, they would stop at St. Mary's Cathedral. They have a tradition. They have a mass before every game, and they would stop at the cathedral for that mass. And I was a little guy who was a server, and I was around, and the good priest had said, why don't you serve for these guys? And so I got to serve for the Notre Dame football team, and so I got to see these guys. And I have at home, I have an autograph book that was signed by John Lujack and Frank Leahy and all those great people of football of that era. But I got to see them, and so there was a little bit of that involved, I suppose, in it.
So you were an altar boy?
I was.
Yeah. When you saw these football guys in church, did you go home and eat a lot and hope you grew?
No. I just figured I was going to be whatever I was.
Yeah.
But I was an altar boy, and as was my dad before me at St. Lawrence, and my son after me, mm-hmm. and my grandson. They've all done their duty like that.
So I'm going to ask you one more question, and I'm giving them a chance to think here is what I'm doing. But I want to ask you about your mom again and the business about giving back. Did you tell your children that? Did you pass it on?
Sure.
Tell your grandkids that?
Well, I don't see the grandkids quite as much as I do, but you have a chance to nudge them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and part of it would be to say to your kids, here's an opportunity for you to do something you might enjoy. This, go do it.
Okay.
And pretty much they did. They did. You know, my son holds a best example of this. Is he holds a appointment from the governor as a member of what is called the Regulated Amusement Device Safety Board. Which is a really interesting.
So you're going to have to tell us what that does.
Well, the regulated amusement. Well, there was a woman who was killed in a park accident at Thorndown.
I remember that.
And that was during the Frank O'Bannon's term. And the legislature got all worked up about that, so they discovered that there were no rules about the maintenance, care, and any of those amusement rides. And they also discovered the proliferation of those rides at county fairs and street fairs and all that kind of stuff is unbelievable, but they had no rules. So they created a board called the Regulated Amusement Device Safety Board. And this board was to write all these rules and to continue to bring them up to date and everything. And I had the occasion at that time to have friends that were in political positions, and so, and my son at that time was superintendent of parks in Lafayette, so he knew a lot about this kind of stuff. And I said, Ted, what do you think about this? This would be a good job for you. Well, Dad, I have to get in. And I said, Dad, don't give me all that stuff. Well, let's see what we can do. So I put the fix in. He got the job. Frank O'Bannon appointed him. He has been a member of that board since Governor O'Bannon, and he is currently the chairman of that board. And although he doesn't work in the park world anymore, he's at Purdue now, he still maintains his seat, and Governor Pence just reappointed him. So that's an example of how I nudged him forward. And my daughter, she was a little tougher to do, but she was a basketball player. And so that took an immense amount of her time, but Connie and I always went to where the kids were doing something. If Amy was playing basketball, we were there. If Ted was doing something, we were there. And it just, that was the way we put our life together.
And your parents did that too?
My mother and dad did that too.
Yeah. Do you want to follow up?
Yeah, I have a question.
And say who you are.
I'm Abigail Delf, and I had a question about something you previously mentioned in the beginning of the interview. You mentioned how one of the nicest compliments you ever received was how the people in Lafayette, when things need to get done, they get them done. And I just was wondering if there were any instances in your life that you applied this as an individual and a citizen in Lafayette.
Oh, but I participated in those kinds of things. You know, for years we had this question of building the state highway around West Lafayette, and we were never able to get much attention from the state highway department, and they kept always telling us that that the people in Lafayette really didn't care, until finally a group of local businessmen decided that that was sure utter nonsense and that we'd show them. So we got the highway department to have a public hearing, and they did. They set it up down at the McCutcheon High School down there, and then this group that I belonged to figured out a way, and we filled the gymnasium. And when the NDOT people showed up, and here was this room full of people supposedly from the town that didn't care, they suddenly discovered a real lesson about Lafayette, and you can get people motivated to do things. The railroad relocation here is directly related to the fact that the mayors, when it was in its heyday, believed in organizing the people. And so every level of progress on the railroad relocation, there was a huge outplay of community interest and everything in it. And when we, whatever we did, it got to be a joke. The mayor had a little group of people he called the Hoopla Committee. And whenever we had a rail cutting or whatever, you name it, the Hoopla Committee got together and figured out how to get some musicians and play some music. And they popped popcorn, and we had speeches and all that kind of stuff to make everybody, and we kept everybody at a fever pitch for years. And guess what? Out of the 8 or 10 of these railroad relocation things scheduled around the United States, this one was the only survivor. And we had, and the other thing too is a community. We have a group right now, and still goes and has for years, Chamber of Commerce group every year that goes to Washington, D.C. First of all, they spend some time writing up papers on what is important to this community. And then they all go to Washington, D.C., and they fly out there and they go meet the congressman and the senator and when it was railroad relocation, we met with the railroad administration and all those people, and it's a huge lobbying effort, but it's a community effort to do that, and that's just one of the elements of living around here, mm-hmm. community effort.
And so do you think then that the people in Lafayette are still just as involved in their community as they were in the years previously?
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. If I look at the guys here in the office, my partner, Newell, who's some younger than I am, has been to Haiti 20 times to do things for the Haitians. Brenda's got a... She just finished a tour on the United Way board. I forget our new kid, Gabe, and he's on something I don't know. McBride is big in the symphony and all those kinds of things. Stapleton is hip deep in a thing to build a new YMCA here in town that will be adjacent to and affiliated with Ivy Tech. Walker coaches basketball for young kids. He was a Big Ten basketball player in his day. All of the people in the firm do something as a participant. We encourage it. And with me, I have said this before, I was absolutely blessed with this bunch. They didn't much care how much stuff I did, and so there would be weeks when I would be gone 2 or 3 days. Now, of course, when you're gone in the law business, you're not billing hours.
Well, I was going to ask you how your colleagues or your senior lawyers in the firm felt when you were not bringing in billable hours. But
never said a word.
Yeah.
They never said a word. Mm-hmm. See, the senior partner who really founded this firm, Mr. Ball, was minority leader of the General Assembly of Indiana. He came from a family. His grandfather was the first justice of the peace of Tippecanoe County. So his family had huge roots in the community. But then he got a little bit of politics, became minority leader of the General Assembly, interestingly enough, when Birch Bayh was the Speaker of the House. And Gable had a reputation for being the guy who read all the bills, and he knew that knowledge was power. But there he was down there doing that, and he was involved in the Historical Society. So our history here is to be involved in the community and encourage our young people to go get something, get involved in something. We don't much care what it is, as long as it's something that makes you feel like you're doing something. And I suppose if somebody anymore would get a little bit too much of that and not enough billable hours, we might say something. But nobody around here bothered me about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, I was in high-profile places, so that everybody saw me in the community. They all knew my name. I was 15 years on the board of Ivy Tech. I was in the newspaper and in the TV all the time. And with the Red Cross, 6 years on the national board and the other places that I was, I became the face of the Red Cross here in town. That helps. And so I think there were a lot of them here just resolved the fact that here was his face on TV or in the newspaper, and everybody knew I was a lawyer. And so it kind of slid off into the other members of the firm, because if somebody called and needed a lawyer and I wasn't here, the girl out there gave him somebody else. Our firm has a reputation providing first-class legal services. We've been around a long time. And we enjoy that reputation, and that's part of it.
Jacqueline?
I'm Jacqueline Hauser, and I did have a question for you. I just kind of wanted to get back to the Red Cross, especially your beginnings. Mm-hmm. You were in the Junior Red Cross, and I was kind of curious what that is.
Well, the Junior Red Cross was, of course, a group of young people, typically high school age, who did things in support of the chapter, like unload the trucks. There's one great picture of my predecessor, one of my successors on the Board of Governors, Sarah, passing out programs at a Muncie area chapter. She was a candy striper. And so the kids did all that kind of stuff, build a float for the Christmas parade, things to do that you brought the name of the Red Cross to the front in the community. So that's what they did, a lot of that kind of stuff.
And you became president of the Tippecanoe chapter?
Yeah, I was president of the junior chapter.
And how did you get that appointment?
Well, the kids elected me. It's a democratic organization, sometimes.
Nice. So with the Junior Red Cross into the Tippecanoe County chapter of the Red Cross proper, was that just sort of a natural transition?
I went away to college. And, of course, that took me away from here. But there was some Red Cross activity with the students at Notre Dame, and I was involved in that some. And then when I got out of Notre Dame and went to Bloomington, you know, occasionally I would visit with the people in the Bloomington chapter, but not very often because law school was a full-time job. And when I got out of law school, I went into the Army, and there was not much for 3 years there. But when I came back from the military, Mickey Martin was still here, and she captured me. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the saga began to be full-time at that point.
Is the Junior Red Cross a recruiting mechanism?
Well, if you do it right, it is.
In other words, you bring them in young and...
Bring them in young, teach them the organization, make them understand, and get them to do things that they like, visit nursing homes and whatever. But yeah, sure, it's a recruiting device.
Is there still a Junior Red Cross?
I think we have, but it's not very active like it was at one time. Certainly here. I mean, this organization thing that we did here, you will find if you press me very hard that I'm not much in favor of it, because I think that the whole, you know, reorganization does not always produce good results.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to look forward to talking to you about that in some detail. Okay. So next time we sit down together.
All right.
And we'll be prepared, I promise. Right. Anything else?
I had a question. You've talked about Mickey Martin a lot, and I was just curious, do you think you still would have gotten involved with the Red Cross had Mickey Martin not drafted you into the Red Cross as a volunteer when you were serving on the track team?
No. No, it was her sheer force of will that got us in and then kept us. You know, and recruitment and keeping people is important. It would have been very easy when I got out of the Army for me to drift off and do something else. You know, plenty of things when you're 24 years old to do in town.
So when you went to Notre Dame, it was an all-male college.
That's right.
How did that experience influence you, other than it was hard to get dates or something, but I mean...
Oh, yeah, it was painful. But you had the girls over at St. Mary's.
Yeah.
But outside of that, and if you needed it, if you had a dance or something, you know, on one of the dances, I brought a girl from Lafayette up there, and you had the mechanisms of finding a place for her to stay and all that stuff. And, of course, we didn't have cars either, right. So which made things a little bit
different. So there were no cars on campus in those days?
No cars on campus in those days. So on the weekends where we had those dances, they would permit you to have a car. So if I remember correctly, I double-dated with Tom Klesserth from Fort Wayne. And on Thursday, we would get in a bus and go to Fort Wayne and get his car and bring it back. You know, and so there were all kinds of ways to do it, but... That wasn't a part of the problem either.
How did being in that sort of all-male environment influence you just generally in terms of your education?
I just got good classroom education from great professors and that sort of stuff. And I made great friends. Some of them yet to this day are friends. And so the fact that it was an all-male institution probably didn't... we were all living in the same environment, so... Mm-hmm. So there wasn't anything there. We didn't have girls, so we didn't... that didn't raise a problem. A lot of the guys had girlfriends at home. So when they took a weekend off or something, that they could do that. So I don't think that had anything to do with anything.
So after you graduated from Notre Dame, you then attended Indiana University Law School.
That's right.
Why Indiana University?
Well, because I was admitted at Notre Dame, I was and applied also at Indiana. Indiana offered me a Krannert scholarship, and you know, at that age, when somebody says we'll give you $1,000 to come to school, that can tilt the decisional process real quick. And I see your students are smiling about that, so they must know what I'm talking about. But no, I got the Krannert scholarship, $1,000, and so based on that, I went to Indiana. And I had some friends that were in Bloomington, and so that helped. And a lot of the high school people that I knew were going to Indiana. That was a perfectly natural thing to do. So I went there and enjoyed every minute of it. Faculty was good. Indiana enjoys an immense national reputation for a state school. Still does to this day. So that's how I ended up down there.
So you graduated from law school in 1961, mm-hmm. Right? Why law? And I know that you mentioned that you had
my mother always said that was a mistake, that I should have been a history teacher. But that was the one thing I didn't pay attention to with her. On the other hand, I thought the law was an interesting way, and I saw Murph's practice doing well, and he made a nice living for him and my Aunt Dorothy. And he was well known around town, and had a great reputation. And frankly, I didn't think about being an engineer or anything else like that, so law just seemed to be the way to go.
So you graduated from law school in 1961, and 1961 was kind of a big year for you. You graduated from law school and you went into the military.
That's right.
You're commissioned as a first lieutenant, United States Army, on active duty from 1961 to 1964, and most of the time, judge, advocate general.
Well, I wore that branch, but I did gobs lots of other things, as only the military would do to you.
So that's what I wanted to ask you, is what you did when you were in the military.
Well, I was, because of some, well, the actual thing was I found out very quickly after I got signed up and everything that because of a judge advocate general's policy of his officers knowing what combat arm officers do, he made us all go to the infantry school. So
At Fort Benning,
yeah. You bet. Been there? Yeah. So I went to Fort Benning, I didn't have a uniform. I had not 1 minute's worth of military background, nothing, when I walked in. And in fact, I didn't even have a set of formal orders. I reported to active duty with a telegram. And there I was at Fort Benning to be in the infantry school. And so I learned all of the things, because we were in the same infantry course that the ROTC graduates and the officer candidate graduates and all those kind of guys. My student company commander when I was at Fort Benning was a Rhodes Scholar, just coming back from his tour in England as a scholar. Interesting guy. He ended up as a major general, as a matter of fact. But I did that, went to the infantry school, and then by quirk, I had taken some classes in law school in international law. We had an old professor down there, Austin Clifford, who had been a World War II judge advocate. And he taught international law, I think, as much as anything, for as a hobby. But he taught it, and we had to have electives, so I took a mess of his electives. Well, they showed up on my transcript. When I got to the judge advocate school, somebody was going through everybody's records, and they discovered these things in my record, and they said, wait a minute, he should not be sent to Fort Riley, Kansas, which is where they originally were going to send me.
There is a God.
Oh, you bet. So they said, no, we're not going to send him there. We're going to transfer him to a thing called the 95th Civil Affairs Group, which was one of a kind. These were the lineal descendants of the old military government units in Second World War that governed Bavaria. And I discovered that there was only one of them on active duty. That's where I ended up. And there were about 60 or 70 of them in the reserves. And that was because the technical nature and education required for the officers in this was not something that the regular Army could customarily provide all the time. So here I am in a unit now. The unit had about 65, 70 officers and about 145 enlisted men. Every officer had 2 degrees. Every enlisted man had one. And our job was to become the administrators of other countries if we were deployed to do that. Well, you can imagine that we didn't deploy very often, but we were on everybody's contingency list, so we planned and did all of that stuff. And I ended up, because of that, ended up doing war plans for not only my unit, but then the annexes for war plans at 18th Airborne Corps and what was then called Strike Command. I did all that stuff. And that required a security clearance. And I did all that stuff. And once in a while, I would find myself not having anything else to do, and some cook or something who'd gotten himself in trouble would come by and say, would you defend me in front of the court-martial? And I did. And I traveled a lot for him on planning and that sort of stuff. So I did a lot of that governmental stuff that a civil affairs unit would do. Because of the infantry school, I found out very quickly that when we were getting ready to go to places like Cuba, the way that worked is that the unit would get ready to go, but there would be an advance party, a small group that would go in first. And guess what? Here's this captain with an infantry school background. He looks like he is really an expert to be the executive officer of the advance party. So I'd have a combat arms guy as my boss, and then me. And then and off we went. And
so you actually went to Cuba? Or
we laid under the airplane wings for about 3 days while they decided whether to go or not.
And this was during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
You bet.
So you were ready to go?
Oh, I had all the equipment, my team jeeps and 10-inch, everything we had was in the belly of that C-130. There was no airport at Fort Gordon. There was a city airport, town airports, which is what we used. Mm-hmm. And we would lay there under the wings until somebody said, well, it's a go or it's not. But meanwhile, it was all packed in the airplane, mm-hmm. ready to go. And we had done lots of study. And well, I'd like to go back to Cuba now just to see. My partner, my bride, was there 2 years ago, and he said, it's absolutely a remarkable go.
So just for the benefit of somebody who listens to this, where's Fort Gordon?
Georgia.
Okay.
Aiken, Georgia. It's the site of the Masters golf tournament.
Okay, so what did you learn while you were in the military doing all that civil affairs work?
I learned...
That carried over to your civilian life.
I learned, first of all, I learned how to command men. And one woman, and that's I don't know whether you call it an art or a skill or whatever it is, but it's not easy to develop, and so I learned how to do that. Because there was some effort to do something, I ended up in the temporary duty a lot teaching, and I taught international law and economics because my bachelor's degree was in economics, and I taught U.S. Reserve officers who were getting their points and their rank qualification. I taught regular officers who were on their way to Vietnam, and then we had lots of Allied officers from, you name the country, I think we had them there. And so we taught them too. And you learn an awful lot about foreign countries by just socializing with their people. One of the most interesting men I dealt with was the Turkish officer. Turkish soldiers are tough. They really are tough, and they have a rigid system over there, and he was a good soldier. The Koreans, good soldiers. The Japanese were good soldiers. I mean, and you develop that sense. You know, I never met a German officer, though, who fought on our front in the Second World War. They all fought the Russians. I always thought that must have been a real problem, how they do that. I knew, what we all knew is they were lying in their teeth, but that was their way of kind of a defense mechanism. But, you know, I met all kinds of those people. I met reserve people from all over the United States. So I just got to know and meet a lot of people. Teaching class, as you should well know, is something that it's an acquired art. You go up there and you can stand there and be stupid for an hour, or you can stand up there and really do things. And we had to work in a military classroom from a commandant's rule. Commandant's rule was, if the students fail, it's your fault. Which is a really nice impetus to make your job work. But we wrote a lot of our own lesson plans, and we did a lot of stuff like that. And these classes would range everywhere from a South Korean second lieutenant to a U.S. Army bird colonel. So they were really wide-ranging classes. But you learn how to handle people from the podium. You learn how to present things. It's, you know, I have no fear today of going up to a podium and giving a presentation in one of my zoning matters. Give me the facts. You know, give me the paper in 10 minutes so I can read it, and now I'm on my way. That kind of thing. So there was a lot of practical experience in that. The odds and ends, when I did do courts martial and everything, I discovered the military court system is not as bad as everybody would have you believe. The Miranda warning was given in the military 20 years before the civilians got around to it. You know, you had different kinds of crimes and things that we sometimes don't pay attention to in the civilian community. The military does really gets all upset about travel voucher fraud and that kind of stuff. They get really upset about that, going AWOL, those kinds of things. I kid everybody here in town, I'm not the only lawyer in 10 counties that's ever defended a man charged with bigamy. You girls know what that is? Mm-hmm. That ought to be a homework assignment. Bigamy is having too many spouses.
Multiple wives.
Multiple wives. Or multiple
wives. It was a man, whatever, you were defending a man.
Yeah, multiple wives. And the Army took a very dim view about that. And so I defended the guy. Mm-hmm. And you learn an awful lot about people when you're doing this kind of thing. So the military experience for me was just absolutely great.
So you're a young man who grew up in a relatively insular mm-hmm. family-related community in yeah. Lafayette, Indiana, and all of a sudden you're thrust into a situation where you're with officers from pretty
everywhere.
Much all over the world.
Everywhere, yeah. yeah. Mm-hmm. And then I had my own group of my own team, mm-hmm. and as only the military would do, they sent in a couple extra lieutenants to be on my team, and I was senior only because I had three more travel days than these other two guys. You know, pure military accent, which there's a lot. You know, and one of these guys, I still remember him, he hated the job. He hated the Army. Got up every morning, and if something bad didn't happen to him that day, he went to bed mad at night because it hadn't. And nothing I could do to him in 3 years got him to, went to for him, to got him to understand that the system is so big that if you fight it, it will grind you up. You know, go along somehow and figure it out. And if you work at it, you can.
And so go along somewhere and figure it out.
Figure it
Did
out.
Did that stay with you after you got out of the Army?
Oh, sure. Figure out what's the problem here. What are we trying to do? Where are we trying to go? So I've had a lot of experience of doing that kind of thing.
What did you learn about leadership in the Army?
I learned about leadership is that it's something that you have to work at. You have to work at and you have to learn how to be fair with people. And you have to know your business. When you talk to them and start to correct them, you better be right. Yeah. So I learned a lot of that. You know, you're dealing with guys who have barely a college education, or sometimes not even that. Maybe they have a high school education, come from poor communities, draftees. I guess back in my day, there were draftees. And so you learned that you had to work with them and you had to teach them, but you had to be fair with them. You had to be fair. And it was a great experience to do. And when in this funny kind of unit, I was not like being sequestered over in the judge advocate section where you went to work every day and clean uniforms and work behind a desk and did all that kind of stuff. You know, I had a team that had to learn how to put up a CP tent. You know, those kinds of things.
CP?
Command post.
Yeah. The recorder doesn't know that.
Yeah, I yeah.
So. Okay, so you got out of the service in 1964, mm-hmm. came back to Lafayette.
Yeah.
Is that when you joined this firm?
I did, because my law school roommate, who was also my high school classmate, who to this very day is probably as close to me as a brother, even though he lives in California. We talk all the time on the phone. Mm-hmm. Jack was not eligible for the Army because he was 4F. Mm-hmm. And so he was here at the firm. He became a partner. I show up from the Army. I become the new young associate in the firm, and off we go. Mm-hmm. And here I am still.
So it was that network you developed while you grew up here.
Part of the network that we grew up,
home.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. Yeah, my Aunt Dorothy was Jack's dad's secretary at the bank. You know, and again, this town is really, really interconnected and small.
We're going to start talking about the Red Cross, but it occurs to me as you're talking, is that the way the Tippecanoe County chapter of the Red Cross worked?
There was a lot of that, because we were able to go out in one of the last years of our existence. By reason of our connections, our board of the Red Cross here had the county sheriff, one of the police chiefs, the Purdue fire chief. We had the director of the county EMS. We had three or four bankers. We had a good, strong board of people who had great ties and anchors in the community. And a lot of that is just because somebody in a board said, why don't we call Jason over there at West Lafayette and see if he'd like to be on this board? And, you know, you call the police chief. Actually, you don't call the police chief. You call the mayor and say, we'd like to have your police chief on the board. You know, And then when the word dribbles down and the chief gets the word that the mayor would like to see him publicly in that kind of role, it happens. But again, it's a question of knowing people and knowing where to touch the button.
So the board was organized to take advantage of...
community assets.
And that included, I assume, not just power and influence, but money.
Okay, well, there was some of that, too.
Yeah. So,
but this is a generous town, mm-hmm. and while we had people who had money, we had people on the board who knew how to obtain money. And so, you know, we never, I don't think this board ever failed to make its goal for a year.
So part of the board's responsibility is to raise money.
You bet. Part of the board's responsibility.
What's the secret to raising money?
You got to ask.
Well, you gotta other ask. Than just asking.
Well, you got to have a product to sell.
Right.
And the Red Cross is an easy product
to
sell.
All right, that's where I was going with this. But, how did you sell the Red Cross?
Well, you know, around here, the Red Cross was notably seen a lot in one-family fires. With the year we had the tornado in Monticello, it was the Tippecanoe New County Chapters people that were in there first. We beat the National Guard and the National Red Cross people in by probably a half a day. You know, so we were there. We were a presence in the community. And at the family fires, you'd always see a team from the Red Cross there taking care of the family and feeding the firemen and doing those kinds of things. So we were a force at delivery in Tippecanoe County and regarded as good at what we did.
So the product you were selling was a force that delivered.
Yeah, and we also, of course, did the other stuff, the Red Cross, the service to military families. You know, you've got a kid in Germany whose mother is here and she's dying, and he wants to come home just for the last thing. How do you get that done? Well, the Red Cross knows how to do that. We have that process, and we would do that for people, and that's a very valuable thing, to be able to provide that kind of personal service.
So you're back and you got a job here at the firm.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get connected back with the Red Cross?
Mickey called me. She knew I was back in town. Well, he got in the newspaper that I'd come home, a little article.
Uh-huh.
I'd come home and she called. Mm-hmm. Said, hey, I've got a seat on the board of directors and you're it. It was almost as if there was no discussion. Just, here it is, buddy. It's your duty to take this seat. And with her, she was such a great person, and her husband was such a wonderful man. You couldn't tell him no.
So that was in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you're still there.
I'm still around.
Why'd you stay so long?
It's a good organization. It's a good organization, and it grows. You know, I've seen people come and go, and there are times in a lot of organizations that you probably guys like me could stay too long. You know, so you let grow some other people into the job, coach them along. You know, the older guys ought to become mentors. And we had a fair amount of that kind of thing here.
Do you think of yourself as a mentor?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. In what way?
Well, I have these young fellows in law here. Because of the funny world in which I work, I have to explain to them occasionally, you got to know your community, and the way you do that is do this. Read these kinds of papers. You learn what's going on in town. Go ahead and join this organization. Sometimes they'll come in and say, I've been asked to be in this organization. What do you think? And to be able to give them some value judgment on that.
Do you think that mentoring is an important part of leadership?
Sure is. Absolutely. Absolutely. If you don't train your successor, you haven't done your job. Mm-hmm. And I think, hopefully, I've done that everywhere.
Including at the Red Cross?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you become affiliated, you accept a seat on the board of directors of the Tippecanoe County Chapter of the Red Cross. What were the responsibilities of the board when you accepted that seat?
You had personnel supervision, you had fiscal supervision and responsibility, you had the raising of the money. Most of us on the board, you know, had some thought that you had a little bit of responsibility to participate in service delivery. I remember when the explosion up here on 18th Street in Lafayette, two houses blew up. I spent half a day in the parking lot directing traffic. You know, it's not that I could do anything else there, but we had to help the law enforcement people get the people out of the way and all that kind of stuff.
So this was a natural gas explosion?
Yeah.
And do you remember when that was?
Not right offhand.
Okay, we can go ahead.
Well, it was in the term of Mayor Heath.
Oh, Mayor Heath, okay.
Yeah. But our guys, it was not uncommon for one of the members of the board to also be on a disaster response team. It was not uncommon for one of the members of the board, a banker, to be the guy who had oversight over our budget and to do those things. So, yeah, you had to be a participant.
Do you remember from those early years what the size of the operating budget of the chapter was?
No, I don't.
Or any idea how much money you had to raise annually to keep
this? Well, see, we were blessed here because for all those years, we were in the United Way here. And the United Way fully funded us every year. Mm-hmm. Fully funded us every year. And so what we picked up on the side was things for extra disaster calls and that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And in the last years, we were running a thing called a Heroes Campaign, where we, it was kind of a funny kind of a tree affair where you recruited people, and one man recruited another, and he did that. But and I think in the last year of that campaign, we raised $70,000. And
the Heroes Campaign was intended to recognize.
It was heroes. The guys who were raising the money were really the heroes. It wasn't intended to recognize anybody.
All right.
Just give us the money.
It was a fundraiser.
It was a fundraiser, pure and simple.
Okay.
But it worked.
Mm-hmm.
It worked. And you got a lot of people involved in it, which helped.
And the money that you raised was intended to be used for what?
Well, it was intended to be used for local purposes, mm-hmm. but in many cases, we also had laying out there a national quota for a disaster or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, right now, I saw there the other day that down in Texas where they're having the floods,
right.
They're going to have a terrible time on funds down there. There just isn't enough money. And so they're going to have national fundraising to help that problem down there.
So when you joined the Tippecanoe chapter, who were some of the key people involved in that chapter?
Well,
who made it go?
Who made it go? Of course, Mickey made it go. We had guys like John Martin, a banker. Still lurking out there in the distance was Mac Lehman, who had been a governor of the National Red Cross. Sarah Schwartz, who was a local gal. She's a Edward Jones affiliate now, and mm-hmm. she had been a Red Cross person since we swore over here that she had been left in a basket of bulrushes on the chapter at Muncie's front porch,
mm-hmm.
So she was there. She ultimately became on an interim basis the treasurer of the American National Red Cross while they ran an organizational problem. We had Sarah, and we had Mr. McElwain for a while. He was the only black principal of the local school system, a great man. Great man. Nelson Parkhurst, who was the registrar, chief admissions officer for Purdue. One year we had, for a term, Nancy Hansen, whose president, her husband was the president of Purdue.
Mm-hmm.
She was an interesting lady. She was a very grand lady. She said to us, you know, I'm not going to be able to be coming to all the meetings. My job. And we all understood. We said, yeah, we know that. She said, but I tell you what I will do. I will guarantee you that I will do one thing a year, at least one thing, to help the chapter. We said, fine. Do whatever you can, Nancy. Come to the meetings, whatever you can. But we know you're out there if we need you. So she thought about that, and then from that point on, while Nancy was the spouse of the president of Purdue, the annual meetings of the Red Cross were at the president's home at Purdue University.
Hmm.
Out there, it's a big, nice big old house out there. What that did was, some of us who'd already been there, we knew what the house looked like, but those dear, sweet little old ladies who did the busy work at the chapter, the phone calls and all that stuff, you know, to get to be invited to the home of the president of Purdue University. So Nancy figured that out real quick, and this was a grand night's excursion for a lot of those old volunteers, and it was a funny form of recognition. So Nancy did that, so we had Nancy on board. Like I say, we've always had considerable effort by the law enforcement and EMS people to be part of our process. We've had the wives of people like the wife of the Eli Lilly facility here was on our board. You know, so we had those kinds of folks. So. And then we also had the people around the edge who were, while they were not on the board, were the kind of person that the chapter manager could pick up and call. And indeed, Mickey finally gave up and couldn't any more work, and we then had a succession of chapter managers who were all pretty good people, too. And we were, but that's again, we have a in this town, you have literally a reservoir of good people. Mm-hmm. So you can do some picking and choosing, and we had some great ones. But even on the fringe, you had volunteers who were not on the board who would step in and do things. On the Heroes Campaign, my wife always became one of the participants in the process. Or if we needed 25 phone calls paid for something, one of the other wives would do it. The women of the board or the men of the board were always around someplace doing something. So it was just a wonderful community effort.
What kinds of activities were you personally engaged in those early years?
Well, I was fundraising a lot, and organizational matters like writing and rewriting and doing those kinds of things with chapter constitutions and bylaws. And then I was also kind of on the liaison with the United Way, those kinds of things. And it wasn't too long after my tour that I started to get dragged upward in the system of the Red Cross.
Have you ever contributed your legal talents to the Red Cross?
Well, on a local basis, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I needed to check the contract, the lease for the building they're in. Mm-hmm. That kind of thing. Read this lease, plumber, is it all right? And we do that, sure.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to hand off again, and I hope that I got the dates right on this. So April 11, 12, 1965 was the great Palm Sunday tornado outbreak in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And I looked this up, and if I got the right number, there were 44 people injured in Tippecanoe County. It was an F4 tornado that came through here. Mm-hmm. Was the local chapter involved in any of that? What happened?
As far as I know, we entered in and did...
Because you were with them.
I was with the chapter, yeah. I was a new guy on the block, though, at 64. But I knew that the chapter was involved. We did the typical support services for people. Mm-hmm. We maybe back in those days, it's hard to remember because we've done so many. But if we took housing, we figured out how to do that. Mass feeding, if we needed to do that. Mm-hmm. And we've always had a strong relationship with both the churches and the National Guard here. So when it came time to have places for people to go and everything, we did all that. So yeah.
Were you ever personally involved in disaster relief type operations?
No.
Oh, alrighty. I had a question. When we first visited your office at our previous meeting, it was April 22nd?
I think so.
We saw a bunch of collections that were on the wall, a bunch of pins you liked collecting. Some of those pins were actually from other religious organizations who had kind of their own renditions, you said, of the Red Cross wanting to serve other people, because at the time the Red Cross was more of a Christian-based organization.
No, we're not a Christian-based organization. It's just that we flew the reverse of the flag of Switzerland, and the Muslim societies look at that flag as a cross.
Okay.
They don't see it as a Red Cross emblem. They see it as a religious emblem.
So they misunderstood
it. So they really, truly misunderstood it. So we were not Christian-oriented. We were relief-oriented. But in Iran, the Iranian people, for their own purposes, looked at the Red Cross as a Christian emblem, and they wouldn't fly it, so they flew the Red Lion and Sun. And the Muslim societies flew the Star and the Crescent. And the Israeli Society flew a Star of David.
Mm-hmm.
And these are national societies. They're all the functional equivalent of each other at the International Red Cross. They just all fly a different symbol, identifying themselves because of their own peculiar religious backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's all of them are coming together for the same goal of the Red Cross, but they all have their own different symbols.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and they're all organized. If you go to Geneva, you will find that the International Committee of the Red Cross
mm-hmm.
is made up of representatives of all these different national constituents.
All right. And then I had one more question. You talked about how you needed to sell the Red Cross kind of as a product so that you could actually be bringing in money for the organization within mm-hmm. your community. What were some roadblocks? Did you ever face any severe roadblocks?
Well, no. Again, the Lafayette's a great community, but one of the things you have to sell, of course, is you got to go out and convince the park departments that you have a product for water safety, lifeguarding, and that sort of stuff. And we do have some competition in first aid. Mm-hmm. You know, the big competition is do you take Red Cross first aid and learn how to do the Heimlich maneuver the way we do it, or do you do the Heimlich maneuver the way the Heart Association does it? Mm-hmm. So there's always some of that kind of conflict. And it's not really conflict. It's competition, and it's good. It's good. So we've had that over the years. But mm-hmm. around here, again, Red Cross was so strong for years that when they said, we will do X, Y, or Z, mm-hmm. You know, you knew pretty well you could take it to the bank. It was going to get done.
Well, I actually am really interested in your collection of Red Cross memorabilia and the history of it. And I wondered, what made you start collecting that?
I think probably what happened was that I was at a meeting or a convention, and some guy from some foreign country handed me his pen, you know. And I thought, gee, that's kind of pretty. I wonder why. So I put that in the tie box at home, and pretty soon you had six of them, and then you had mm-hmm. 10 of them, you know. And so you, so I think you just it's just one of those things. And then one day I was looking at these, and somebody said to me, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you had a whole collection of those things? Well, I had a list of all the Red Cross societies in the world, and we had a funny kind of computer typing system back in those days. And I said to one of the girls, can you address an envelope to all these people? She said, well, sure I can. I said, do it. So she addressed them all, and then I crafted a letter and sent it to about 100 foreign countries, and got back what you saw in there was immense responses. Some of the responses were really neat. You know, some of them were funny responses that would come back in a box that would have 15, 20 pins. So you had this vision of some guy saying, shh, now I know how to get rid of this. Whoosh, and he put them on a box and said, mail this crazy man in India. Or there was one I remember that was from one of the little islands in the Pacific, an independent nation island, and they wrote this interesting letter about how that I hoped that they hoped that I wouldn't think badly of them because their pen was not beautiful and lovely, but they were poor and it could only be this. And it was indeed a little pen in plastic and cardboard, you know. But I've got it; it's in the collection in there. Then I picked up some other ones from just people who knew I was doing it. A friend of mine walked in one day and said he brought this back from World War II, and he had an American Red Cross pen from the German Society, and under the German Nazi government society, the Red Cross pen had a swastika on it. And I always thought, well, I'll bet the crustaceans of the day were offended big time by that. But by and large, they maintained their peace and kept their mouths shut, I'm sure. But it's interesting, and you know, the collection was fascinating, what's on the pens, some of the letters that I got, all of that kind of stuff. So that was what it's about. And then, of course, you pick up the our own national pens. Every chapter has one. And so that, again, was one of those things where somebody, you'd go out and speak to a chapter at their annual meeting, and right away the guy would take your lapel and put his pen on it. And so you walked out of there with a collectible on your lapel. And then the antique ones, I developed a technique of every time I went to an antique show or something and find a mess of Red Cross pins, those old tin pins of what kind or another, many of them had dates and everything, I'd buy a handful of them. And then when I went to speak, if the chapter chairman who was introducing me did not have a Red Cross pin on his lapel, he got one. And that was my way of getting my speech started. And so that's that, and the collection started that way. And there's a lady out in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Shirley Powers, who is the real collector. And she even has a book. I can go into my collection and say, yeah, that book, that pen was issued by the New York chapter, such and such. And then, of course, in the World War II era, we were a uniformed operation. And our respective services, the Motor Corps, the nurses, whatever, all had a pen, a Red Cross pen, but it had a different color in it and everything. And so you were identifiable by your pen about what service that you were doing.
You have a few other items as well, including a letter from Clara Barton.
I do.
How did you come across that?
My wife found that. She knew that I collected this stuff. If you went through my home, you'd find that there are 8 or 10 places in the house where there are Red Cross posters. Some of them are collectible. You know, I have a Harrison Fisher of the Greatest Lady of All, and it's probably worth $1,500 or $2,000. But I picked them up at auctions and that sort of stuff, and over the time, and you do that. People give them to you, and it's just kind of a fun thing to do. And at someday, I'll have to figure out what I do with them. That's what my kids want to decorate their houses with. But I'll figure out a place. They'll go someplace. I'll give them to the Indianapolis chapter, and they can put them down there.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite collector item that you've collected over the years?
Oh, gee. There are a lot. And so the Red Cross is really interesting. Those letters by Clara Barton are truly fascinating. But there is and Clara Barton wrote a book. Mm-hmm. And if you really want to read about the Red Cross, you read Clara's book. But then there was a Canadian poet who, by the name of Robert Surface. Does that one strike a bell with you? What did he write?
I don't know, but I've actually done a lot of work in Canada.
Okay, well, Robert Surface was, as I remember, a Red Cross driver, ambulance driver in the First World War. And he wrote a book called Rhymes of a Red Cross Man. But the thing that makes you wonder about his mindset and everything was that he is also the guy who wrote the great barroom ballads, The Shooting of Dan McGrew, you know, and those old Yukon poems. He wrote those, and that book is kind of an interesting collectible. And I've got one of those. I found one at the sale. So you pick up those kinds of things, but you do see lots of interesting things in the Red Cross that are there. And you know, my own personal original Red Cross pen was given to me by a man by the name of Joseph Andrew. Lafayette's a small town. Joseph Andrew, who ended up as a lawyer here in town. He was a member of the Board of Governors of the American Red Cross in the early 1950s. We ended up, when we moved to where we live now, across the street, Joseph Andrew's daughter lived. And she was also involved in the Red Cross. She was chairman of volunteers. But when I got involved in the Red Cross, and one of the first meetings I came to, Mr. Andrew was there. And he said to me, here, and he took off his pen. And he said, let me give you my pen. And I still have that pen. It's in that stuff that's in there, that Red Cross pen.
Was that an impactful moment for you when he gave you his pen that kind
of... Well, it was kind of an impactful moment because it taught me something about how the Red Cross deals with people. They never let you get away if they can figure out how. And it creates great memories. You know, great memories. I remember the year that the president of the Red Cross, General Collins, came to Lafayette, and we discovered that when General Collins had been a lieutenant, he was a lieutenant with a man by the name of Charlie Weislogel, who was a captain of industry here in town. Charlie found out that the general was coming and had a group of us in his home, and we had this wonderful evening listening to these two old men reminisce about their military experience when they were lieutenants, for God's sake. You know, that kind of thing. To this day, there was Mr. Lehman, who was my predecessor on the board. His son still lives here in town. And every now and then, the boy, who is an adult, retired now, will say to people, Bummelberg was a friend of my dad's. One of the most unusual friends, because politically they were 100 miles apart. But sitting listening to these two guys talk was fun. And you know, and to this day, he remembers this Red Cross relationship that was created. So the Red Cross does a lot of that.
Is that an important part of sustaining the organization?
Sure it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, Shirley Powers has her website with her pins, and you know, and the Council of Former Governors, we constantly are getting stuff from Washington, and we have that annual meeting every year. And you know, there are just lots of those kinds of personal relationships that are around. Walter Liang, who was a member of the Board of Governors after I was.
So personal relationships really matter.
You bet they do. Sure they do. Walter lives in Washington, Spokane, Washington now, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, Walter's a guy who's had every political job he can get his hooks into, and depending on who's in office at the moment. You know, he's been an administrator for the VA and all kinds of things based upon political appointments. But he's such a charming character. And that was the other thing, personal ones. We had a man on the board by the name of Herbert Hoover, his wife Meredith. he'd come to the meeting, lived in California, he'd come to the meetings in a real motorcycle and a sidecar. And the reason why you'd recognize his name is because his grandfather was the President of the United States. You know, so there was all of that kind of thing. You know, we all got to visit with Bob Dole when Liddy Dole was on the board or was the president. There was just amazing connections like that. We're watching all these things at masquerade as debates right now. God help us. If Frank Stanton was alive, he would be having a hissy fit over it. Because Frank Stanton, Dr. Stanton, was our president at one point, and he was the vice chairman of CBS, and he's the man who created the original great debate between Kennedy and Nixon. And if he watched this, it would just turn his stomach. So there's this personal side of it that is just absolutely a remarkable personal side. Every now and then you get a call from some guy who says, "Hey, I haven't talked to you lately. What are you doing?" And that's okay, too. That's fine.
I'm going to ask you one more question right now about the Topeka New Chapter. And we have a few general questions, and we're going to wrap it up.
Okay, and I have something to show you.
Okay.
I took this off the wall at home. In the lore of the Red Cross, I became the chairman of the Committee on Chapter Relations of the Board. Mm-hmm. That put me on the Executive Committee of the Red Cross. It also was a chairmanship of chairman, one of the several, but I was first among equals because of that chair. We discovered that we were having trouble getting the chapters to send in their quotas and their fair shares and everything. And we discovered it was a huge amount of money. So as chairman of this committee, and we discussed that, and I appointed a subcommittee chaired by a man by the name of Byron Tynes, who ran a big department store in Gretna, Louisiana. A gracious southern gentleman. And he and a little committee studied us, and they reported back in about 3 months about the gravity of the problem that we had. And then the board said, "What are we going to do?" And then, so they decided that I would communicate with all the people who were in arrears. And the consul and I constructed this letter, which essentially says to them, "You are in arrears X bucks. And if that number is not right, then you call us, talk to us about it. But if it is right, we want to know right now a plan on how you're going to pay it. And if you don't, we're going to send some agents of the Red Cross in to do two things. To put you on a plan to pay your arrearages, and two, to have you sign statements of fiduciary responsibility." This thing became known in the lore of the Red Cross as the Bumbleberg Letter. It raised, within a very short period of time, $900,000 of money that people were not sending to FISA.
Chapters had a fiduciary responsibility to the national organization, and a lot of them were ducking it.
Ducking it,
and
sure.
I'm looking for the January 9th, 1980, mm-hmm. the Bumbleberg letter.
Yeah, and so this letter, and this one is a copy of one of them that was sent. It's an actual letter, and I got that copy, not because I kept one, because I didn't. Why, I'm not sure. But this was given to me by the characters who ran the Indianapolis chapter when I left the board, when I retired from the national board. They all had a big reception for me, and one of the things that Ralph Taylor had was this thing. Put it in the lore, and it raised all that money, and it had the effect of turning around the remittance system and starting the curve the other way rather than down.
So it became the expectation to pay rather than not pay.
That's right, and we discouraged funny things. We discovered, for example, that we were sure that chapter executives were lying in their teeth to their boards. And then I remember one letter I got from a guy, and essentially he said, "I have your letter, but I feel obligated to advise you that I am no longer the chapter chairman, having been left the term last week, so I will pass the letter on." And I had a vision of this guy getting my letter and saying, "Thank God," and handing it to the guy who was his successor and saying, "Here, buddy, is your first problem." So that's a piece of interesting history right there.
So this was done in your capacity as chairman of the Committee on Chapter Relations.
Yes.
And it's the committee of...
That was the...
The National Red Cross.
National Red Cross. The Committee of the National Board of Governors.
And how did you get appointed to that committee?
Well, the nominating committee of the board, mm-hmm. did that every year and selected people. and parked them into those jobs.
Was the fact that you were a lawyer have anything to do with the
fact that you were chosen to write that letter? No, we had all kinds of other lawyers on the board, so that didn't have anything to do with it.
So I want to ask you about the latter half of the 1960s. So you've been on the local chapter for a few years at that point. And you know, that was a period when there was a lot of social turmoil in the United States.
Sure was.
A lot of it was centered at universities, and you're in the shadow of a huge state university here. A lot of that turmoil related to the war in Vietnam, but not all of it. There were lots of issues involved. So did that social turmoil of the late 60s have any impact on the Tippecanoe chapter of the Red Cross?
You know, I don't think it did. I think we were able to stand on our neutrality, to do our thing. That's not to say that the kids at Purdue aren't active. You know, I remember the night they marched on downtown. And again, some of our leadership was pretty wise. The guy who wore the star as sheriff at the time was a wise old policeman. And I was with him that night. I was riding. And they hear this, all these kids are coming downtown, and they've already, you know, made their actions over at Purdue and stirred that place up pretty good. Now they were downtown, many of them, hundreds of them, milling around, blocking the streets and everything. And I still remember, I said to the sheriff, what are you going to do? And he said, well, all these streets around here are cordoned off now by police agencies of one size or another. And I have told them to stand back and just let the kids alone. And if they don't do anything wrong, let them alone. And then he said, I'm going to tell you something. After a while, they're going to sit down because they're going to get tired standing up. You know, he was right, they did. And he said, and then they're going to discover that asphalt at night is cold. And when their fannies get cold, they'll all get up and walk back to the campus and go in. And you know what? He was absolutely right. We dispersed that thing without one single police incident. Now, they arrested some of them over at Purdue. Yeah, Purdue has its own police department. And, well, I think most state universities do now.
So I just will say for the record that you're wearing a uniform shirt for the sheriff department merit board.
That's right.
So why were you riding along with the sheriff?
Because part of our job is to know about the department, so we ride with them once in a while just to see what they're
doing. So you're on the merit board then as well?
Yeah, I was on the merit board. I'm the original survivor of the first merit board.
So you've been on a long time.
I've been on a long time.
Okay.
But we do. We ride. We ride with the young deputies and everything. And how can we judge promotions and all that kind of stuff if we don't have a little bit of knowledge about what it is they are subjected to out there? So we do. That night, I just happened to be around, and the sheriff said, get in, so I did.
When you became affiliated with the Red Cross in 1965, how was the Red Cross in Indiana organized?
We had the chapters all through the state, and then we were organized, if I remember correctly, on a division system. And we were part of the Indianapolis division, and I think that maybe there might have been, the Lake County might have been part of Chicago, and there may have been a Fort Wayne division.
And were most local chapters organized by county?
Yeah, they were, yeah. And some of them had more than one county, and some counties had no Red Cross except who was next door, that kind of thing.
Red Cross runs on volunteers.
Sure does.
And you've been doing this for a long time. So when you think back about all the years that you've been affiliated with the Red Cross and all the experience you've had in a variety of leadership positions, most all those volunteer positions, what have you learned about why people volunteer?
I wish I could remember. Frank Stanton always used to explain that. Frank always used to say, people volunteer because one of the things that we've discovered is if you leave it up to the government, it doesn't get done very well. And he had a second reason. But the last reason is it's good for the soul. It doesn't harm you at all to enjoy what you're doing and get some pleasure out of helping. I'll have to dig in my records and see if I've got that quotation. It's a dandy.
So when you were attempting to persuade people to volunteer, is that the argument you made that it'll make you feel good?
No. I've always made the argument that it's good for your town. You want somebody to answer the telephone if a serviceman calls? Do you want somebody to be able to have blood if you're down in Indianapolis at the blood bank? You do that. Oh, by the way, who do you think is going to give the hot coffee and stuff to the firemen when they come and your house is burning down? Or find you facilities to live in? You do all those kinds of things because it's necessary. It's good to do. And if you feel good, that's great too. That's just an added benefit.
How are you doing on time?
It's about 5 minutes to 12. How are you doing?
We also need to leave at noon. So,
okay.
I'm going to wrap this up by reminding listeners that we talked to you earlier about your mother telling you you got to put back. And you also told us that when we met with you on April 22nd and we talked to you about volunteering, you said all it took was me to spend some time. So using your mother's good advice as a starting point, of all the organizations that you could have picked, right, to put back or spend time with, why the Red Cross? And why did you stay for all those years?
I stayed all those years because I believed in the program. Mm-hmm. I guess I picked that one because Mickey Martin got to me first. but you know, that's it. And you know, and the question of time, I was quoted once in the newspaper when somebody said to me, "How do you manage to do all that stuff?" And flippantly, I said, "I don't play golf."
Uh-oh.
And which got great chuckles from everybody in the room. But there is an element of truth to that. Golf can take a lot of time. You could spend a whole afternoon, a week, you know, doing that. And I could take that 4 or 5 hours and do something else with it, which is what I did.
I think that we're going to use this as a stopping point.
Okay.
And it's a relatively good place to make a clean break. And
okay.
We'll schedule a second round with you. And at that point, we are going to want to talk to you about Senator Grassley and the reorganization, mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And it seems like doing it all at one time in one place made some sense.
Okay.
So I am going to turn this recorder off. And if you hit stop on that one and make sure the numbers aren't running, so we're really off.